Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Faculty of Horror, podcasting from the horrid halls of academia. I'm Alex West with
Andrea Subisati.
And we are back for an oft-requested episode topic. This was something that has been in our minds for a while as something to do, and something we've kind of, I think, maybe inadvertently, yet a bit purposefully stayed away from. And today we're going to be talking about rape revenge films.
Yeah, I think that's really accurate because, you know, we announced it and I was looking forward to it. I'm so glad we're finally going to tackle this. It's been an elephant in the podcast room. We've got to get there someday where we're finally going to do it. But then sitting down to do my notes and to do my research, I didn't enjoy working on this episode, folks. I'm not going to lie. Like, the first word on my notes is just the word rape, all in caps. And when I typed that out, I kind of stared at it for a while and oh, shit. It's not a nice topic for us to research. I think this is going to be a complex topic for many of you to hear. Alex and I were talking about it before we started recording. And whatever your experience, everyone's experience with this is so different. It probably goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway, that we are going to talk about rape in this episode. And we are not going to offer anything that the Faculty of Horror doesn't usually offer, which is to say our personal observations, our personal feelings about the depictions of rape in these films. But we don't endorse any particular reaction. There is no right and wrong. I don't think either of these films is a particularly correct or appropriate depiction of it. And that's part of the complexity of the topic. And we're going to get into that.
And having done this podcast for just over 4 years now, we've come to see that a lot of you engage with us in a very intense and personal way. And that's great. That's kind of what we do this podcast for. But all that going to say that, again, if you want to reach out to us after this episode, please do. But Andrea and I cannot speak for everyone, nor do we want to, because in the myriad of stories about rape and sexual assault, no story is the same. And everyone has different reactions to their own personal stories, to stories that their friends or their families have told them. And we don't really want to condemn or endorse any one way of doing something or living with it or surviving with it. And it's an ongoing discussion that we are having continually in our culture because it keeps happening. And it's scary and it's weird and it's strange, but we look to film, we look to that big bright screen in front of us to help us make sense of the world around us. And I think the two films we're going to talk about today do that to some degree in very different ways. And on that note, I am excited to talk about that dichotomy. But again, this is a deeply personal topic. Your experiences, whatever they may be with this, are relevant and they are true, and we believe you.
So the word rape, it's weird because we all know what it is, and yet it's something where the definition of the term is so, so important because the legal definition of the term defines how it is legally prosecuted, and the legal treatment of the subject is very problematic and very much in flux. It's something that's still being argued over and deliberated, and a big part of being a feminist in 2017 is being part of this conversation where the legal system is doing survivors wrong. The term, it's a blanket term for sexual activity without one party's consent, and that encompasses physical force, coercion, abuse of authority, or activity with a person who is deemed unable to give consent due to age, disability, unconsciousness, etc. Fun fact, marital rape was legal in Canada until 1982, and the FBI considered rape solely a crime that could be committed by men against women up until 2012. So when I say that this stuff is still under deliberation, these conversations are still happening now. It's an old topic, but it's also very current.
And so much of what we understand about rape in popular culture and in the world around us has to do with men assaulting women. But again, hopefully it goes without saying that everyone listening to this understands that woman-on-woman rape can happen and that man-on-man rape can happen. Sexual assault and violence also disproportionately affects the LGBTQ community, and it's a very real problem. So while we do kind of have an almost collective understanding and a visual representation of rape in one one way. There are a vast myriad of ways this can be approached. And I think that's why when we talk more about rape and why rape becomes more part of a cultural conversation, different stories come up. And, you know, as Andrea was saying, for a long time, if you were in a consenting, generally fine relationship, and it was assumed that all the sex was fine. And you can be in a consenting relationship and even a happy relationship, and one time it's not consenting, and that's still rape.
Now, sociological conversations about rape deal primarily with the topic as it pertains to power. It's not just a sexual gratification thing. Anybody with working hands can take care of their sexual urges. And even if you don't have working hands, there's an entire industry for that, albeit underground. The fact that rape is more common between acquaintances and during times of war underlines that there is a serious power dynamic at play. And I think the World Health Organization identifies principal factors of sexual violence as beliefs in family honor and sexual purity, weak sanctions for sexual violence, and ideologies of male sexual entitlement. And so these three factors really underline the power dynamic in rape, which we're going to talk about more shortly.
So one term you may or may not be familiar with is the term rape culture. And this is a word that gets bandied about a lot. And I personally believe it's a very important term, but a lot of people, particularly on the internet, seem to strike a very big issue with it. They don't like it. They don't believe it. They mock it. They're concerned about it. And so to kind of just generally talk about rape culture is at a very high level. It's a culture that teaches people not to get raped rather than preventing people from raping. It's the kind of culture that teaches women that if you don't wear short skirts and if you don't go out late at night and you're always, you know, accompanied by other people, you won't get raped. And we know that's not true. And even if it does happen in those circumstances, it is still absolutely not okay. So I think a lot of the discourse and discussion around rape culture is there's a lot of gray areas there. And there's a lot of people who feel blame thrust upon them, even if they maybe haven't done anything. And there's an innate defense mechanism that gets activated in people. And they take to Twitter, they take to YouTube videos to air these grievances and make fun of it. When really, in my opinion, what rape culture does in the discussion of rape culture, when it's a positive, generous conversation, is draw attention to the ways that society, especially our Western society, is disproportionately advantaged to certain groups over others.
Well, that's right. And rape culture also signifies prevailing attitudes that normalize or trivialize sexual assault. So even if they're not dealing with specific cases of sexual assault, when we're talking about rape culture, we're talking about how other norms in our culture are steeped in this idea that men are walking sexual urges and women have to be the guardians of that kind of behavior. And that includes stuff like slut shaming, that includes victim blaming, it includes violent sexual imagery used in advertising, it includes street harassment, it includes phrases like "you know you want it" or "asking for it" in pop music. It's everywhere. And personally, if I could trace my own journey into feminism, my wokening, if you will, by singular watershed moments, one of the first would be checking my privilege as a white cis woman. That's a journey that you undertake and it's still ongoing for me. But second, it's been seeing rape culture everywhere. And it's everywhere. It's like Rowdy Roddy Piper taking off his sunglasses and They Live. Like, once you see it, you can't unsee it. And it really is everywhere.
I remember when I was really young, I think I was like 12 or 13, and I was walking with my parents in our neighborhood in Toronto, and a guy who was older, maybe a teen or early 20s, like kind of wolf whistled at me. And I'm a quick walker, and so I was kind of walking a bit ahead of my parents, so he probably didn't assume I was with my parents. And it, like, caught me off guard, and I remember looking back at my mom, and she just said, "Oh, that means he likes you." And just feeling like, oh, but I didn't like that. And my mom is amazing and, you know, that kind of like real second wave feminist, but she was kind of pleased in a way that someone found her daughter attractive. And it's no judgment on my mother, but it was this real moment of like, oh, I'm an object in some way. I am on display. So you have those moments, and once you start seeing those moments, I think it was within that moment that I started kind of self-policing, because, you know, you internalize this rape culture and it was like, oh, I don't want to be that girl. Mm-hmm. I don't want this kind of attention. I want to be known for different things. And it's not the correct way of thinking. It was just something that happened. And I think a lot of people have internalized those moments. And now if you're kind of woke to all of this stuff and you're checking your privilege, you start to see different ways that maybe you can dismantle it, but understand that some of this stuff is just so ingrained.
Yeah, it's really difficult. It's difficult to undo 30 plus years of aggressive sexual objectification. Like, you don't do that overnight. And as much work as I do for myself in trying not to police myself in terms of what I feel like wearing, not to pass judgment on other women, on what they're doing and what they're wearing, that's not to say that I don't walk home with my keys in my fist. I do. But I certainly have a changed perspective about women's role in rape culture, is that we've really been socialized to perpetuate it. And it becomes a really unfortunate sticking point that pits women against each other.
I will say one of the most depressing moments in researching for this episode, and there were a few, was just looking up the term rape culture on Google, which I'm maybe hesitant to recommend anyone do.
No.
But, you know, for every one thoughtful video or article that explores the implications of rape culture, there are several others condemning it. And for me, it was almost like the white, cis, I assume straight dudes who were making these videos. I'm like, unfortunately, I kind of expected that. But the ones that got me really hard, and I watched a few of them, were the young girls, like maybe late teens or early 20s, who were just mocking rape culture. It broke my damn heart.
Yeah.
And that is hard, because you want to talk to them, but I don't know if you can be talked into believing something like this until you start experiencing it for yourself or someone close to you does.
Now, insofar as rape is something that's understood to be taken seriously, that's actually kind of part of why it doesn't get taken seriously, especially if you look at things like online culture, like Alex was just talking about, but particularly in gaming culture. To say that somebody got raped, this is the kind of rhetoric that is embedded in video game culture, and it's part of the reason why people get so defensive, is well, that word doesn't mean that in this context. And they don't maybe realize how problematic that is, because it normalizes the word and it contributes to rape culture. But it's kind of in that same vein that there is an entire subgenre of exploitation films that was especially popular in the 1970s that generally follows a consistent three-act structure. There is a rape, the survivor regroups, and then exacts revenge on their rapist. And sometimes the revenge portion is carried out by someone close to the victim, as is the case with the original Last House on the Left, I Saw the Devil, Irreversible. The list goes on.
And rape had existed in popular culture and popular media or literature well before the 70s. It existed in some of the earliest forms of literature. I mean, that was all about rape and maidens and all of that kind of stuff. And so it was part of a discourse in some way. And, you know, you have different interpretations of it and different schools of thought, different schools of literature and the way they approach it. And it even goes back to some of the earliest films. You know, I'm thinking of D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, the original racist KKK emboldening film, which is horrific and nasty in so many ways. But it features, you know, the fear of a black man raping a white woman. And then the Ku Klux Klan ride in, and they're like the heroes who hang the black man. And it's disgusting and vile. And it also treats women as property and creates a kind of weird hero complex around rape. And in the film, the woman is so threatened by this black man that she actually kills herself. She like throws herself off the side of a cliff rather than, you know, potentially being raped. So it has kind of existed in film, and the threat of rape has existed in film. But part of the important thing for our discussion about the kind of 1970s rape revenge exploitation movement is that it was kind of in keeping with the rise of second wave feminism. The fact that women were fighting to have rape recognized as a horrific and despicable act was pretty big, and it hadn't been part of the discourse in the same way it had been before. I mean, rape was kind of this mysterious thing that happened. But for me, what the second wave feminists were trying to say, and I think did say a lot, was that it happens way more than you think, it's more fucked up than you think, and there's nothing we can do about it unless someone starts helping us. So these films for me are kind of the, okay, fine, no one will help us, society won't help us, our culture won't help us, so we've got to take this into our own hands. And these aren't my favorite movies by any stretch of the imagination. I think I've seen most of them, and they're just hard to watch. It's not that they're not well made or not interesting or not thoughtful or provocative, which are all things I really love in film, but they're just frankly hard to watch. And it's even harder to watch knowing that for so many women, like, there is no recourse for them. And so these kind of fantasies play out in a very specific way. And I think the idea of rape revenge is really interesting because it's a conversation about what defines revenge for you. Is it the survivor getting revenge for herself? Is it someone on behalf of the survivor or the deceased victim getting revenge? Or which someone was asking us on Twitter or on Facebook if we were going to talk about Irreversible. And I talked about Irreversible in my book, and I had a hard time pegging it as rape revenge because within that film, and maybe skip ahead if you don't want spoilers for Irreversible, there is a brutal 9-minute rape scene, like real-time rape, and it is horrific. And then Alex in the film, who is played by Monica Bellucci, is beaten by her assailant. And then her boyfriend and her friends here are getting carried off in a stretcher towards the ambulance. And they go on this hunt through the darkest parts of Paris to avenge her. And in the end, they kill the wrong person. And it's this kind of like fucked up tragedy. But I don't know if I would term that rape revenge because I don't know if the rape is avenged. But I've seen people argue very forcefully for Irreversible being rape revenge. But I would also posit something like Baise-moi, which is a really great punk rock kind of Thelma and Louise-like story, would also kind of fall into that category of rape revenge. But it's part of the discourse. And for me personally, I think I prefer to see the survivor take initiative.
I feel that way as well. I always feel like when somebody else carries out that revenge, it's almost as if – and I found this to be particularly the case with Irreversible. And I really like that movie. It's dizzying. It's unique. It's harrowing. It affected me very deeply. And so I like it insofar as I don't want to see it again anytime soon, perhaps ever again. But I think when it's her sexual partner – who avenges the rape, it's almost to say, you took what's mine. I get a twinge of that when it comes to that movie. I get a twinge of that when we're talking about Last House on the Left, because we're talking about a girl who is a minor and then her parents. And that, like, your sexuality belongs to you. And so I kind of feel like the revenge should belong to you. But again, these are all projections of the ideas surrounding rape and do not at all reflect the real lived experiences of, my God, if someone close to me became raped, I would tear someone's fucking head off. So what am I even talking about? But for me, like, what's most useful about discussing the subgenre as a whole, and this has come up in the Faculty of Horror before, is how consistently rape is used to provoke a female protagonist to action. We've talked about it before, how 9 times out of 10, if you want to provoke a powerful woman in a film, you either rape her or you fuck with her kids. And it all points to a pervasive anxiety about women and sexuality and how women's sexuality has to be controlled. There's this virgin whore binary, especially as it pertains to horror, where female sexuality has to be regulated. And if it's consensual and premarital, then it's deviant and a slasher will take you out. And if it's non-consensual, then it's up to her to right that wrong. And as fucked up as it is to hear myself say that, that narrative actually contains a powerful social critique because it acknowledges that survivors don't get justice from the system in one way or another. And I think that's really important to point out.
And before we delve too much further into the discussion of this and we get into the films, I think we should just briefly touch on some of the reasons why people don't come forward after sexual violence or assault or rape. Not only because it can seemingly be very hard to prove in a court of law because it is one person's story against another, but also because oftentimes it can re-trigger or re-traumatize the victim. And if you're not assured of getting justice, then sometimes it's better just to live with it. And there's more and more psychology studies I'm reading about this, about people trying to look for more holistic methods of treating sexual assault survivors or getting them through the kind of trial process if it gets to trial. And there are so many stats around this that you can, you know, look up if you don't know them already. But it's staggeringly low, the amount of cases that actually make it to trial. And even then, the conviction rate is so low. So before anyone jumps on anyone for, you know, saying vigilantism is wrong, it's like, no, vigilantism in these movies, it's taking us through a narrative which might not be realized if the character sat and went through a courtroom drama, which they actually do in the Jodie Foster movie The Accused, and she gets justice, and, you know, they go through that kind of whole court procedural thing to kind of make sense of it. But that was, what, 88, 89? And we're still having the same problems, if not worse. So without further ado, we're going to delve into our first film, which is Mir Zarchi's 1978 film, I Spit on Your Grave.
Take off your clothes.
I don't like women giving me orders.
I spit on your grave. What you are about to see did happen. I spit on your grave. This woman will soon cut, chop, break, and burn five men beyond recognition. And there isn't a jury in this country that will convict her.
I'll give you something to remember for the rest of your life.
I spit on your grave.
Jennifer Hills has decided to leave her Manhattan apartment to spend the summer at a remote cottage in the country to work on her first book. She's friendly with the locals she encounters, including Johnny, a gas station manager, his buddies, Stanley and Andy, and Matthew, a developmentally challenged young man who delivers her groceries. Matthew is apparently friends with the guys from the gas station, and when he reveals that he knows where she's staying, they decide to pay her a visit to rid Matthew of his pesky virginity. The guys abduct Jennifer when she's out sunbathing on the lake in a canoe, towing her boat to shore and tearing off her bikini. They goad Matthew into raping her, but he won't, so Johnny does. When he's finished, Jennifer wanders naked and bleeding through the woods until she encounters them again, and this time Andy rapes her. Once again, she escapes and finds her way back to the cottage, but the guys are there waiting for her, and she's assaulted by Stanley and raped by Matthew. They leave, but realize that one of them should kill her to cover up their crime, so they send Matthew back with a knife. He can't bring himself to kill her, so he dips the knife in her blood and claims that he did. Jennifer slowly recovers from her trauma, resumes work on her book while she plots her revenge and visits a church to ask for forgiveness for what she's about to do. She kills them off, one by one, starting with Matthew, whom she seduces and actually has sex with before getting a noose around his throat and hanging him. She also seduces Johnny into a bath with her before cutting off his dick and leaving him to bleed to death in her bathroom. She kills Andy and Stanley with their motorboat in the lake, and the credits roll as she boats away. Now, I've actually already talked about this film at length on the Rue Morgue podcast. On episode 27 of the Rue Morgue podcast, I was a guest. That particular episode is still available on iTunes as of right now. And then I actually returned to the podcast to discuss the film's terrible, terrible sequel called Savage Vengeance by director Donald Farmer, which we tore apart like a pack of wolves. And anecdotally, Donald Farmer has since friended me on Facebook, and he had a real kick out of that episode. So the guy can take a jab.
There are so many things to me about I Spit on Your Grave that are deeply frightening. On one hand, there's the kind of scenario of it all. As a writer, as someone who has friends who are also female writers, we all sit around, we'll have like a glass of wine and be like, man, I would love just to get, like, a house by a lake and just, like, bring my laptop and just write this fucking book or this play or this movie or this short story, whatever I'm doing, and get it done in some peace and quiet. And from the outset, that's Jennifer's modus operandi. She's getting in her car, she's going to this place, and she just wants to be left alone. And when she encounters people, she's friendly and nice and warm because we're assuming that's who she is. And the way her space is continually invaded throughout the film is absolutely devastating. You know, if you want to go back to that Virginia Woolf quote, that all that one requires is a room of one's own. The fact that there are entrances and exits within this home, not only are these people not invited in, they break in and then they assault her repeatedly throughout this. And even to the point where early in the film, Jennifer is kind of lackadaisically taking a break from writing, sitting in the hammock, and the motorboat starts going by. And she gets frustrated enough, and there's just this brief glimpse on her face that she's just like, I don't want to fucking deal with this. I'm just going to go back inside my nice cottage and do whatever in there. But she has to leave. She has to leave this space. That constant forcing out of occupying space that she has rented and paid for is horrific, and it's so upsetting. And then the rape, it's like the sequence of rapes and the sequence that Jennifer avenges them. There is the, you know, half hour of rape that just happens, and it stops and you think it's over, and then it continues. I mean, one of the most interesting things to me about this movie is that the rape is upsetting. It is upsetting every time it happens. It is upsetting on multiple levels for reasons we will get into. But at the end of it, when they rip up her manuscript, when they rip up her writing and they just kind of throw it on the ground, I was just like, it brings something up in me that's inarticulate. Like, it's the rage and the violation of it all. And it's a violation on every level. So I think when you want to talk about the experience and the horror of rape, I think that's maybe what I Spit on Your Grave does so well and so articulately.
I'm not going to say I love how this film belabors all of the violence in her, but I do appreciate the fact that it shows the different ways in which rape culture impedes someone's life, the different ways it affects her. You want peace and quiet? Fuck you. You came here to work? You want to create something and do something for yourself? Fuck you. That's as bad as the rape to me. And look, I don't want to defend this film. I cannot defend. It's a crude little exploitation movie. That's what it is. But it does bear mention that Mir Zarki, the writer and director of this film, was inspired because he came upon a bloody woman at the side of the road who had just been raped, and he took her to the police. And they interrogated her very harshly through a broken jaw. And he was horrified, and apparently that is what motivated him to make this film about a woman taking justice into her own hands. And while I'm not entirely sure he nailed that point totally effectively, he definitely pats himself on the back for making what he thinks is a feminist film. So I'm just going to put that out there.
There was a lot of critique and a lot of scorn when this film came out. It's almost kind of one of the most famous things about it. Roger Ebert was one of the most vocal critics against it, calling it almost every name in the book and saying that no one should see it and it's a deplorable film, all that kind of stuff. And a lot of film critics were kind of saying in its heyday, when it was released in 78, that it in some way glorified or sexualized the rape. And I think we've made this point on the podcast before, but I'm going to say it bears mentioning again. For me, when you see women being assaulted or violence against women in film, unless it's saying that hitting or raping women is cool and fun and you and your friends should totally do it, that to me would be a misogynistic film. In I Spit on Your Grave, it is the real, visceral, horrific occurrence of rape in the aftermath that I think would be traumatic for anyone. So to say this film is somehow misogynistic makes me question the intentions of the people who are saying it is misogynistic. To me, that means I think you actually just have a problem with our culture and what our culture covers up and what it denies. And when it's presented to you and you're saying this is happening and you know what, it's probably happened to someone you know, then that's actually a much bigger issue than I don't like this movie. It's a bigger issue with culture.
Well, that's right. And if you actually read Roger Ebert's tirade against this film, and we will post a link to it because it is worth a read. He hated the film. That much is absolutely certain. But what I found really problematic about his outrage was when he was in the cinema, a female patron who was also in the cinema stood up and expressed some form of solidarity with Jennifer when the revenge part was happening. He didn't describe it any more than that. Maybe she stood up and said, fuck yeah, cut off his cock. I don't know. But he wrote in his review that he felt like saying to her, well, how did you feel about the rape part? And to me, that's just him imposing tremendous judgment. This woman felt solidarity with this woman, and I don't like that because she got raped, and that's not right. And so I feel like you really have to assess your own standpoint on the subject before you really take a position on this film. Personally, I appreciate that this film really encompasses all the negative space around rape. It talks about rape culture very directly, particularly in this scene with Johnny.
Come on, this thing with you is a thing that any man would have done. You coax a man into doing it to you, and a man gets the message faster. Look, whether he's married or not, a man is just a man. Hey, first thing, you come into the gas station and you expose your damn sexy legs to me, walking back and forth real slow, making sure I see them good. And then when Matthew delivers the food to your door, my, he sees half your tits peeking out at him. Tits with no bra. And then you're lying in the canoe, in your bikini, just waiting. Like fate.
Now, I didn't really go into detail about this part in my plot synopsis, but what happens is she's disposed of Matthew. She goes to the gas station. She convinces Johnny to get in the car with her. She drives them out somewhere and pulls a gun on him where he spits out this crazy rape culture rhetoric. And it takes her aback. I think in the film, we're supposed to think the way Johnny thinks, that maybe she's actually considering that. Maybe she's actually internalizing some of the blame. Like, this trauma is very fresh in her mind, so who knows what she's going through. And all of a sudden, she's like, yeah, yeah, okay, you're right, let's take a bath. And then she does what she does, and you know where her head was at all along. But holy shit, does he lay on the rape culture rhetoric thick.
And it's 78 that this is happening.
And it's the same shit you hear now.
To me, the ability of this film to illustrate that kind of culture and to show how it happens is incredible. And I thought it was very interesting, the inclusion of the scene at the beginning when Jennifer first gets to the cottage and she sees the beautiful lake and the place where she's going to hang out and write her book and just be herself without the eyes of the city on her. And she takes off her clothes and jumps in the lake. To me, it was absolutely not sexual. If you think you're all alone in the world and you want to jump into a lake, fuck yeah, go for it.
Innocent.
Yeah, it was completely innocent. But the connotation that she can't do it after that, it feels so, again, it feels invasive and it feels terrifying. And Carol Clover writes about it quite a bit in her book, Men, Women, and Chainsaws. And she talks about urban versus rural and urbanoia versus kind of a countryside aesthetic, and how we, the audience, are meant to embody an urban culture with liberal elite, if we would call them now, that they're us, we're that. We're the people with the smarts and we know what's going on. And then we go to this place that kind of time has forgot. And everything comes crashing down around us. And it's like society, civility, everything has come away from it. So it's a strange dichotomy to see someone who, in Jennifer, has kind of lived up to this urban experience, has gotten stories published. She's taking the time for herself. She's going to go, she's going to sit, and she's going to write, and she's going to see what happens. Versus, again, this notion of the men that time has forgotten. I mean, the two guys are unemployed. Johnny is a dad to like two kids, and Matthew is mentally handicapped, and it's bizarre, like these men that kind of emerge out of the mists of time to kind of tear her down and tear all of her accomplishments away. And the fact that this all exists within us and it's part of this animalistic or more human side of us that civility and society has taught us to grow out of. What I think is quite, for me, singular about I Spit on Your Grave is the way it kind of oscillates between Jennifer's story and the men's story. The way that the men, this little group of men, kind of justify the rape in that it's about teaching Matthew how to fuck, and how when he actually does, in kind of the third setup at her cottage, when he does get to rape her, how they kind of cheer him on but also give him advice. The men somehow justify their violence, and they seem so set on it that this was something that should happen and that it can happen at the expense of Jennifer because she is just kind of a city whore, or whatever they're going to call her. She is expecting this. She is open for it. She is ready for it.
Yeah, it's very impersonal. Like, they don't even seem to talk about anything particularly about her. It's not that she's a writer. It's not that she's from the city. It's not that she's especially attractive or unattractive. None of that matters.
I will say one of the things the film does is it codes Jennifer as really feminine. She's wearing, you know, really cute dresses, high heels, looks great in a bikini, and she's just comfortable. Like, that's her aesthetic. That's what she wears. And really the only other woman we get kind of any interaction with is Johnny's wife, who is like a mom with a capital M. I mean, we love moms, but this is kind of the sitcom-esque iteration of a mother, you know, in like all denim, kind of bedraggled, like two kids clinging off her and just like yelling at men.
My husband fucking never disappears on me. He's not that kind of a man. He's loyal to me. He's a good father and a good husband.
So Jennifer, in some ways, is an antithesis to this motherly figure that exists in this world. It's almost like Jennifer is a zoo animal, something that they're gawking at, and then they break into the zoo after hours and are just like poking the zebra. And I think on the other side of the coin, we have to talk about the way in which Jennifer is able to enact her revenge, particularly on Matthew and Johnny, which is to sexually entice them. And some people find issue with that, and that's cool. You can totally find issue with that. Again, no rights or wrongs, just analysis. Now, for me watching it, it's definitely, especially if you kind of come to watching I Spit on Your Grave knowing it's rape revenge, after the brutality of the rape scene, you're like, fuck yeah, Jennifer, kill them. And so you're waiting for her to do it. And the fact that she's kind of like soft-spoken and wearing this like beautiful white robe thing and her hair looks amazing. And you're like, okay, you're not Ripley. All right. And to me, sitting with it and, you know, she seduces the men to disarm them and then attacks, you know, in quite brilliant ways because she's quite slight and she's smaller than them, so she has to be very crafty when she attacks. To me, it doesn't feel problematic because it speaks to the way in which women hold power in society, which is through sexual seduction, attractiveness, availability, any of those iterations you want to talk about. So she is using the exact things that the men expect of her to trap them.
I completely agree with that, and I think that's maybe a chip on my shoulder I have with reading a lot of the articles against this is how could she bring herself to this and this and this and that, and it's really just re-victimizing her to label her that way, that she would wield her sexuality. For me personally, the value of classic rape revenge films is that they expose a really weird binary when it comes to women's sexual power. On the one hand, you've got the rape, which is normally conceived of as a man overpowering his victim physically and forcing his will on her. And in this case, a woman's sexuality is her weakness. Her gender means that she's not physically as strong. She's not fully able to protect herself from the holy grail that is her vagina, and it's taken away from her. Now, the flip side of that sexual power is when Jennifer is able to seduce these men. And part and parcel of rape culture is the idea that men can't control their sexual urges and that they can't resist a sexual invitation, even if it's coming from someone they don't trust and they shouldn't trust. And these men do display a certain amount of suspicion, like insofar as Johnny's like, hey, you asked for it and you deserved it and you did this and this and that. And so, yeah, it's totally fine. But then he's just kind of like, are you sure? What do you mean you liked it? Like, even he's confused by his own rhetoric, and I appreciate seeing that in the film.
Now, as we wrap up our discussion on I Spit on Your Grave, I think it's also important to note that this film has an alternate title, which is Day of the Woman. And a lot of people really like that title. They might prefer it. It's kind of become a little bit of a rallying cry within the feminist horror community, and that's cool. It's a fucking great title. What I find interesting about Day of the Woman, especially within the context of I Spit on Your Grave, is that Day of the Woman comes at the cost of a woman. It comes at the cost of violence against women. Only then will women stir up the resources and the anger and the wherewithal to fight back and kind of claim this day. So in some ways, I really like the title Day of the Woman, but I would like it to belong to a different film. Just of, you know, a woman being a badass and living her life and doing what the fuck she wants by whatever means.
Yeah, we should just call the Faculty of Horror, like, the podcast of the woman.
I think it is, though.
Okay. Never mind.
It basically is, right, guys?
I'm glad you brought that up because I also wanted to bring something up as regards the marketing of this film, which is to say the poster has this depiction of Jennifer walking away wearing this shred of white fabric that I don't even know where that came from. But basically the poster says something to the effect of, I don't have the actual text in front of me, but something to the effect of, this woman has been battered and beaten and bruised and raped and stabbed and punched, and but no jury in the world would ever convict her. And it actually strikes me as darkly funny, because the fact of the matter is, even today, people who are beaten just as badly, people who have been traumatized just as violently, do not get justice. Courts will not see things their way. And so this is a story of someone taking matters into their own hands in the 70s. And still that rings true.
There's also something I find about that poster. And that poster is maybe more iconic than the actual contents of the film in some ways, because it's so visually arresting. And there's something about the poster, and I think it's the way the body is painted, because it is kind of one of those classic 70s B-movie posters where it is a painting, and the way the underwear kind of fits Jennifer and the little shreds of fabric, it seems very sexual. Whereas in the film, she's naked. She's naked. Obviously, you cannot show that on a poster that might sit in front of a movie theater or in a video store somewhere. But there is nothing, to me, sexual about her nudity. There is no male gaze in that. There's something very innocent about Jennifer's body within the film, especially as she staggers away from the rape. There is a kind of anti-sexuality to it. And so to see the poster denote some kind of inherent sexuality in her body, that is more maddening to me as a consumer of the film than the film itself.
That's right. It's not at all apparent in the film. Not only is she nude, but she's very bloody and she's very muddy. She's very dirty. It's not a very erotic depiction of her naked body. Actresses, and particularly models who have become actresses, know how to position their bodies such that it appears provocative from a certain angle, how to accentuate this curve, and then you throw your hip out, and then you put your chin up, and like, I know that. I've done that. I know what that looks like, and I also know what it doesn't look like, and it is not in this film. I don't see those rapes as titillating or eroticized in the slightest. So before we move on completely, just so that nobody comes at us with, why didn't you talk about the remake? I have very little to say about the remake. I think the remake is universally panned and not quite in the same way that the original was. It's not controversial like the original. It's just bad. It's complicated by some slasher tropes. We've got this newfangled Jennifer bringing marijuana and alcohol with her to the cabin, which sets up this archaic idea of she who must be punished. And then there's the added dynamic of the sheriff, to whom she goes for help, and he winds up joining in on the rape. There are very inventive kills. It's like I Spit on Your Shitty Saw franchise, and there's basically none of this bite that we're talking about that was in the original film, and that's all I have to say about that.
I don't even have that much to say about it because I got about 20 minutes into it. And one of the most powerful things to me about the original is the lack of music in it, particularly during the rape. The only kind of music I remember from that is when one of the guys is playing his harmonica. And I just felt so bombarded by all this like filmic elements in the remake. And obviously you want to make a slick, glossy film. But, you know, there is a sense of cinema verite in the original that I appreciated. It felt more real. It felt more authentic. And I almost don't think of the original as an exploitation film. It feels, frankly, a lot closer to something like a documentary to me. And that's me personally just saying that. So I'm not decrying it to the gods. But there is a slickness to the remake that just instantly was not appealing, and I did not want to continue with it. I spit on your remake.
So that's I Spit on Your Grave, guys. We are going to move on to a very different film in terms of where it's situated in cinema, in terms of where it's situated in the world, and in terms of where it's situated within rape culture narratives. I'm talking about 2016's modern sort of rape revenge thriller, Elle.
Qu'est-ce que tu fous là, toi? Allez, rentre!
Salut.
Ça va, toi?
Ça va.
C'est quoi, ça?
J'ai fait une chute à vélo.
Serrures, en haut et en bas.
J'ai quelque chose à vous dire.
Violée ?
Mon Dieu.
Qu'est-ce qu'ils t'ont dit, les flics ? T'as pas été les voir ?
Bon, commande.
J'ai pris sur le vif. Il était accroupi dans les buissons en train d'observer votre maison.
Et vous avez vu son visage ?
Non, il portait un masque ou une espèce de cagoule de ski.
Tu la raccompagnes ?
Ouais.
Non, c'est pas la peine. C'est joli ton truc là. Tu vas au ski?
Quand tu veux, je t'emmène.
On devrait être encore ensemble. C'est de ta faute.
Tu m'as quitté, Michel.
Tu m'as frappé. C'est pas la première fois qu'il se manifeste. Tu pirates les ordinateurs perso de tous les employés.
C'est grave comme infraction.
Mais il y a un fou qui rôde.
Non, mais les fous, j'ai l'habitude. C'est ma spécialité. Tu t'es bien foutu de ce que je pouvais penser, hein? J'étais dans un déni étrange, mais maintenant j'y vois clair.
La plus dangereuse, Michel, c'est tout de même toi.
Michelle is a mature businesswoman who runs a video game company, takes care of her adult son, has a complicated relationship with her mother, and left her long-term partner after he hit her, though they remain friendly. And she's carrying on an affair with her best friend's husband. Elle begins with a masked assailant breaking into Michelle's home and raping her. She tries to move on and compartmentalize it, but she can't as the assailant breaks into her home again and texts her reminding her of the incident. Michelle is also dealing with renewed public interest in her life as her father, one of France's most notorious serial killers, is up for parole. Even though Michelle was only 11 when the massacre that her father perpetrated happened, there has been speculation about her involvement. The assailant once again breaks into Michelle's home, but before the rape can happen once again, she stabs his hand and takes off his mask, revealing the assailant to be Patrick, her handsome, charming, and married neighbor from across the street. From there, the two engage in an affair where Patrick can enact his fantasies while Michelle seemingly consents. Patrick accompanies Michelle to her business party for the launch of her company's new game. As Patrick drives them home, she tells him that their relationship is unhealthy and that she will call the police. Michelle then enters her home and is once again attacked by Patrick, but is stopped when her son Vincent arrives, hitting him over the head and killing him. In the final moments of the film, Michelle reconciles with her friend, whose husband she was having the affair with, and Patrick's wife tells Michelle that she's glad Michelle was able to satisfy her husband's needs. So if that plot encapsulates anything, it's that Elle is a rather big film. There's a lot of plots. There's a lot of subplots. There's a lot of narratives. There's a lot of relationships. And it all coalesces around Michelle. So this was a film that when Andrea said, hey, I think we should really just, you know, buckle down. Let's do Rape Revenge. And I said, cool. But I really feel like we should talk about Elle. So, Andrea, I'm curious. We haven't really talked about it between you and I, but what was your sense of this film?
Oh, boy. My sense of this film is, first of all, that we really have to keep any discussion of Elle in proper context, which is to say that it's a modern film. It wasn't part of the original rape revenge exploitation movement. It's a critically acclaimed modern thriller that's won numerous awards. Isabelle Huppert was nominated for an Oscar and won several awards for her performance. So I think there's value for the purposes of our discussion in how different it is from the typical rape revenge ilk. One thing I do appreciate about the film is such an alternative depiction of Michelle's reaction to her initial rape. She's clearly freaked out by it, but her cool, calculated response to the incident is very much in line with the character that becomes fleshed out later. We don't get backstory. We don't learn all these things about Michelle before the trauma happens. We learn about it after the fact. And we learn that she's had a bad experience with the police that prompts her to not seek their help in any way, shape, or form because she doesn't trust them.
And we should obviously, as well as Andrea has just said, situate this film in its maker, which is Paul Verhoeven. And some of you may know Verhoeven for his work on films like Total Recall, RoboCop, Basic Instinct, Showgirls, Starship Troopers. And he kind of, after Starship Troopers, faded a bit. He went back to Europe, made another film there, and then Elle has kind of been, in a way, his comeback, even though he's in his late 70s, I believe. Paul Verhoeven is someone I have a bit of a complicated relationship with. I think he's a great director in some respects. I think he's a bit of an enfant terrible, even though he's Dutch. He's a provocateur. He likes to shock people. He likes to fuck with people. And he's created some great satires, like Starship Troopers, an amazing satire of war and propaganda, RoboCop about corporations investing in civil disobedience, all of those kinds of things. But for me, one of the other films of his, which I kind of go back to the most, is Basic Instinct, which is, you know, most famous for Sharon Stone playing a serial killer with an ice pick who likes to uncross her legs. But it has incredibly problematic depictions of rape within it. And I'm thinking most specifically, obviously, Michael Douglas is the kind of anti-hero within the film, a very troubled cop who is succumbing to alcoholism and drug use through the investigation of this crime. But he also rapes his kind of girlfriend, who's played by Janine Triplehorn in the film. And it's never really mentioned again. It's never brought up. It's like this kind of fucked up moment that happens in the film, and she just gets over it in a way. But you should see the film if you haven't already. I think Verhoeven, in a lot of ways, particularly within his Hollywood films, is an almost deceptively entertaining director. He does not shy away from the bombastic elements of Hollywood cinema. So when I heard he made a film about rape, I was like, okay. And it premiered at Cannes, at the Cannes Film Festival in 2016. And it was billed as a comedy about rape, or a black comedy about rape. And I was cautiously intrigued by this film. And so I finally got to see it towards the end of last year. And I will say that I enjoyed this film. I think it is a subversively powerful representation of trauma and of rape and assault. And for me, what it does is it situates rape and trauma within a world. I think the exploitation films that we were talking about in the 70s, there's a notion that an assault or rape happens, and then you act on it. It consumes you, and you cannot rest until it is completed, whatever act of vengeance you want to seek out. And there is a more realistic side to Elle for me where, you know, trauma happens and it's terrifying and scary, but you shut it down because life goes on all around you and you deal with it and things happen. You've got drama at work, you've got drama with your partner, and you have to compartmentalize it. You're almost forced to in a way. And I thought it was a really brash and brave execution of it. And I know some people have a lot of problems with this film, and I'm not denying any of those problems, but I am saying for me, from my experience, there is an absurdity to trauma. You will be going through the darkest period of your life, and people will not know about it. People who do know it don't know how to react to it. So you're in a weird place where you're trying to deal with it, but you also feel like you have to move on, or you want to move on. So for me, I thought Elle was a really beautiful and, again, just for me, powerful representation of that will to move on. But the way she is tracked and prodded by her assailant, it really delves into what we were talking about a little bit earlier with the power dynamics. So I think we will get into that in a little bit.
I think Verhoeven was trying very hard to make a very controversial film. And I think it's worth bringing up because when filmmakers are trying too hard, I feel like there's so much going on with this film that even when he hits it right and he hits on a note that resonates with me, it is obfuscated by so many missteps that complicate things and keep me on the outside of it, so to speak. I feel like he really delights in the idea that he's some kind of edgy provocateur here, and he's fond of saying that he wasn't able to find an American actress who would be willing to take this role, and so he had to take it to Europe because Europe, they appreciate fine art. Yes, yes, like, fuck all of that. I hate that. I think he's attempted to make a film that really complicates the notion of the rape revenge film with a protagonist who is unlike anything we would ever think to call a victim, and also positing a scenario where a woman who was raped turns the tables on her attacker by exposing the hypocrisy of his deviant sexual urges. She's raped, and then she effectively transforms the sexual power dynamic. With that said, I did not enjoy this film. I didn't find it funny. I didn't find it thrilling. I found it at best boring and at worst kind of insulting. And there's a reason I really like horror films, and it's because I feel like they don't talk down to me. I feel like they are what they are, and what I like to do and what I like to do with the faculty of horror is kind of draw this meaning out of it where maybe there isn't that much meaning embedded in it. Whereas this film, I feel like it's kind of the opposite. I feel like it's laying out a huge tableau of pieces and just begging me to pick and choose, which is kind of why I feel like it's gotten all these accolades that I can't really get behind.
And that's what you found insulting about it, that it was, in your opinion, surface level.
It was just throwing too much at me, like, make sense of this. Go on, do it. Oh, you can't? Well, then clap your hands, because it must be brilliant. For me, Elle is less about the thrills and chills of seeing a woman raped and seeing her draw power from it and carrying out revenge. Like, there's so much more going on here. My sense is that the film deals more directly with the idea of trauma, and not just sexual trauma, but we've got a woman who was traumatized as a child by her father's actions at a very early age and carries that trauma with her for her entire life. It was a very public trauma. Her father's crimes were very public. They were very famous. And her involvement, as young and as innocent as she was also very known to the public in the form of a very haunting photograph. And also, she's a boss in a very male-dominated society. I mentioned video games earlier on in this episode as a very male-dominated sphere where domination and subjugation of women is the norm, to the point that she really participates in that to make this video game as titillating as possible.
Yeah, I think the trauma aspect was really interesting to me. And again, I don't tend to return to rape revenge films because, again, with what I've experienced, trauma is all around you, and it's not like it happens and you end whatever relationship causes it. It stays with you. And that's why I felt like there was a lot of reverberations throughout this film. And this film kind of, for the first two thirds, is a bit of a thriller mystery of, like, who is this assailant? Who is constantly breaking into her house? Who has her phone number to text her? Who is doing this? Because if it was up to her, I believe in this film, she would have protected her home, changed the locks, have done with it, put it aside, and just lived her life knowing that it happened. And the fact that it keeps happening, it won't be forgotten, speaks to me about, again, it's the PTSD thing. Even when she's having coffee with her mom, who she has a bit of a contentious relationship with, she flashes back vividly to the rape again, and it happens. But before the assailant can penetrate her, she grabs an ashtray and just beats his skull in. And it's almost an iteration of PTSD, but almost like a rape revenge fantasy PTSD. And I thought that was really interesting. And I thought the film, and again, this is a complicated film in terms of the way it's problematizing a lot of elements in our society, but I kind of got on the ride for that. And what was very interesting to me was the men in this film. And there's like not a good dude in the bunch. The closest good dude, air quote wise, is probably her ex, who is also the father of her adult son. They have a friendly relationship. They have a warm relationship. And it's only, again, towards the end of the film that they say to each other, the only reason we're not together is because you hit me. And he says, that's the thing I regret most in my life. But it created a barrier between them. And the fact that the only kind of able together man is her neighbor, who is the one who must exert power over her, I thought was interesting. And there's even another subplot within the film where at the company she works at, they are working on an interstitial scene in the video game where a female character is raped. And a little viral video goes around where someone has put her face on the female character. So it is this demon CGI thing raping her in this film. And the thing is, that's not part of the rapist's thing. That was something one of her colleagues did, which she uncovers, and she essentially tells him to fuck off. And for me, it felt very kind of realistic. Like, this shit happens all the time, day in, day out. And sometimes they're big ways, sometimes they're small ways. Sometimes it's trauma, sometimes it's microaggressions. And you live through it, you power through it. And for me, that was because in this film, I read Michelle as the most responsible character in this film, even though she's kind of unlikable in a lot of ways. I personally find Isabelle Huppert to be a very kind of like charming, acerbic actress, so I really like her. And I love the kind of like dry, angry wit throughout all of it. And she was the one holding a lot of things together. So if she cracked, everything else would crumble around her. So I responded very intensely to that notion of having yourself held so tight, because if you crack or if you falter, if you waver, so many things will fall apart. It's like dominoes.
I didn't see her as strong and infallible as you did. Like, my sense was that Michelle came to internalize trauma to such an extent that she started seeking it out. Like, she aggressively rejects the norm that people love and cherish their mothers. Fuck that. She rejects the norm that her best friend's husband is off limits. And to me, she personified this like Ayn Randian egotism where she does whatever the fuck she wants and to hell with everybody else. And I found the most telling aspect of this critical egotism is when she sees that Anna, her best friend and also who she works with, she sees that she's having a good time with Robert, even though Anna suspects Robert is having an affair. And they're at the launch party for the video game, and it looks like they might even be on the road to reconciliation, and they're about to leave, and we're having a good time, let's get out of here. And that's when Michelle decides it's a good time to not only confirm that Robert has betrayed Anna, but that she's betrayed her as well. And to me, that's where not only did I lose all sympathy for Michelle, but I kind of lost the ability to broaden this story to anything wider. Whereas when we're talking about I Spit on Your Grave, there's rape culture rhetoric. There's someone that I can relate to and I can see in everyone I know. I feel like this is a really singular story. This is a really interesting microcosm of a rape revenge world within rape culture. And I think it's really interesting and valuable that we had such different readings of it.
For me, it brought up the sense of the quote-unquote perfect victim. And this term is kind of bandied about in rape culture and conversations about rape and assault. And that's the notion of, let's, for argument's sake, use this woman who is innocent and was just minding her own business and didn't court any trouble. and was assaulted and traumatized, and everything fell apart after that. So it's a sense that there is a certain kind of victim which has the kind of stamp of society's approval. And I liked that Michelle wasn't that. I liked that she was complicated. I liked that she was unlikable. I liked that she was selfish and mean, but it felt very personal in a way. It didn't feel kind of like this high-level, grandiose story about rape. It felt like, just as you were saying, Andrea, a very specific microcosm. And so for me, when people talk about Elle as a black comedy or comedy, I relate it more specifically to, it's more of a theater subgenre, though it has kind of leaked into films a bit, but a comedy of manners. And a comedy of manners is a comedy that specifically skewers a specific class or a specific location, a type of person. And I like that Elle is very condemning in a lot of ways of this one kind of upper middle class, bougie, Parisian suburban culture, but also that trauma and fucked up things happen within it. I like that, you know, Michelle is older, you know, Isabelle Huppert is probably 50s or 60s now, and the fact that her adult son is so dependent on her and that Michelle sees through what her son Vincent is going through. You know, he's knocked up this girlfriend and then the girlfriend gives birth and this child is clearly not Vincent's, but it was the moment when she kind of acquiesced it towards the end and she was like, no, it's your son. That, I was like, that's her trying to not ingratiate, but make a bigger leap than she maybe would have before. And there is a sense that Michelle is trying to let other people have illusions. Her whole life has been about illusions, whether it's working in a video game industry, which is misogynistic and problematic, whether it is her mother who is kind of dining out on this weird celebrity she has of being the wife of France's most famous killer. She wants to call people out on all their bullshit throughout the film. And it's like towards the end with her son, it's like she learns to bite her tongue because this will make her son happy, and maybe it's not hurting anyone right now.
That's interesting because you knew that I hadn't seen it at the time that we assigned this. And when I told you I had seen it, you texted me something really interesting. You said that you wished she'd won. And I'd love for you to elaborate on that.
I wish she'd won. Oh, Isabelle Huppert, the best actress.
Oh, fuck. Okay. I thought... I thought you were talking about the character.
No, I actually kind of do think she won because Michelle has two really interesting, powerful moments within the film. And I think Verhoeven does a lot of interesting things with the idea of mirroring. So there's the notion of self-perception and how others perceive you. So that could be something as simple as RoboCop or Total Recall with Arnold Schwarzenegger questioning who he is and what he wants to Michelle in Elle and how she feels that she's so right, but she has to deal with the world around her, which is not as black and white as she would like it. It is shades of gray. And to me, two of the most powerful moments within the film, one is about midway through and her father's still in prison. He's up for parole. The story gets woven out throughout the film about this horrible massacre that he committed. And her mother keeps chiding her. Go see your father. Go see your father. Her mother winds up in the hospital, and one of her last requests to Michelle is to go see her father. So she calls ahead, makes an appointment at the prison, and she arrives at the prison, and they tell her that her father is dead.
Madame Leblanc, votre père est mort.
She goes to see the body, and she leans over this dead body of her father, and she just says, I killed you.
Je t'ai tué en venant ici.
And I was like, mic drop. It was this man who has held this mythology over her whole life, and she adopted some form of control over him. And then at the kind of climax of the film, when Patrick tries to rape her again at the very end, Vincent rushes in, attacks him, and he gets this big, huge, bloody gash on the back of his head, and he kind of turns to her, and he starts to fall, and he looks into her eyes and goes, pourquoi?
Yeah.
Or why?
Yeah.
And she just looks at him. And it was like, really? You really need to ask why? I just thought it was interesting that she held such power in these very small ways. Like, these aren't big wins. It's not like she's like, he's this rapist, he does this. She kind of protects him. And it's only the moment that she has at the end with his wife who's like, I know you satisfied his needs. It's that kind of quiet community around women who know certain things are not right, but there is a kind of internal win in there. But as per my text, I did mean that, oh, I wish Isabelle Huppert had won Best Actress, because I mean, Isabelle Huppert, I wrote about another film she starred in my book called Ma Mère, which is a really super fun incest drama. She's great in it. She's also like plays these kind of like really interesting, sexually complicated women. Also the piano teacher, like a shit ton of films. She's been working forever in France. I just thought Elle is not a total departure for Huppert, but it felt so refreshing.
Well, that text of yours really got me to thinking about winning and losing in this game of rape. And it's such a fucked up, murky thing. And the fact of the matter is, we're living in patriarchy. We're living in rape culture. Nothing about sex is ever going to be black and white and totally devoid of the power dynamics between the sexes. And that's something that was kind of clanging through my head throughout. I felt like Elle was a very tragic film because ultimately I felt like it was her trauma that came to define her more than anything. And I felt that the fact that she was able to carry on this caring relationship with Anna just kind of undid my head. But ultimately, it's important to understand that rape erotica exists. People have ideation about that simply because it's so taboo. And they say, someone says, I wish I knew where I got this. I'll try and find a source so that I can link it in the course notes. But particularly powerful women tend to have sexual fantasies about being submissive because they can give themselves over to something and not be in control of everything all the time, because that's hard and that's work. So it's a very, very murky subject. And this film comes in and out of those murky themes in such interesting ways.
Well, it's interesting because when you were saying the rape comes to define her, I can't think of a character more defined by rape than Jennifer in I Spit on Your Grave. The fact that her narrative ends like as soon as she kills that last guy with the motor on the boat, and then she like literally boats away. And with Elle, I like that there's the coda of her kind of reconnecting with Anna and like these two women realizing that they do really care about each other. They do kind of have a fucked up relationship because Michelle is jealous of Anna because she has a very close relationship with her son. So in a way, Michelle may have been trying to get back at that in some way, but they both look at each other and say, you know what, maybe we can be friends and maybe we can get over this. And that to me, I felt was very powerful. And even at the very end at the house and her son comes by with his girlfriend and who she's had a very tempestuous relationship with. And they kind of hug and they're, you know, it's a lighthearted kind of family moment. And I was like, life exists beyond this trauma. Trauma never really ends. You kind of assimilate it into your life and you cope and you develop hopefully healthy coping mechanisms for it. But there is this world that continually exists around you, and then you find a way to function within that world again. And I thought for me, that was what was so poignant about Elle, and that the film isn't scared of making fun of itself. Like, I love the moment early on, Michelle sits down with her ex and Anna and her husband, who she's having the affair with. We don't know this at this point. And she sits down and she's like, yep, I was assaulted or raped, whatever. And they've ordered a bottle of champagne. And of course, it arrives at the table. And Roger is like, oh, no, we'll wait till we pop it.
Not now.
And I was like, that's absurd. That's absurd. But it's funny and it's weird. And I liked it.
It's interesting that this film had a coda with a weird happy ending, whereas I Spit on Your Grave simply ends with her boating away with two corpses in the water, an axe with her fingerprints all over it, another corpse in the water over there, and a guy dead in her bathtub. And so we don't really get that kind of closure.
And of course, you see the police arrive at the scene in Elle, and they essentially say what happened. And Michelle covers it up by saying, oh, he was masked, which he was. Mm-hmm. We didn't know who it was. And Vincent just tried to protect me and he hit him and he's dead.
Yeah.
So, whoops.
And look at all the evidence I have of the fact that I've been stalked.
And I do want to touch on the fact, and this is one of the most damning criticisms of Elle that I've read, is the fact that Michelle carries on a relationship with her assailant after the rape. And this is a big part of victim blaming. And for anyone who is familiar with Canadian culture, we saw this a lot last year with the Gian Gomeshi trial, who was a big kind of radio, occasionally television personality here in Canada. And there was a lot of hand-wringing over these women who were assaulted, but then carried on a relationship with him. Mm-hmm. And for me, that was, again, one of the many interesting things about Elle is she plays with it. As soon as she unmasks him and doesn't go right away to the police, she has something over him. She knows exactly what he has. He has a wife. He has a beautiful house across the street. His wife is very Christian and religious. And she knows that on some level she can end it. And she subtly hints at that and plays with him. And she's been attracted to him before she knew he was the assailant. And so there's a point when Patrick invites Michelle and her son Vincent over for dinner. Vincent gets shit-faced drunk, passes out on the couch, and they go down to the basement. And he kind of rapes her, but it's consensual. And then she asks him to hit her. And then he essentially says, it doesn't work like that. Mm-hmm. She's withdrawing power from him. And again, it's a complicated scene. And if you have problems with it, I totally understand. I'm not trying to rationalize this. I am saying that it is part of a myriad of experiences that I have not seen depicted in film before. And it meant something to me to kind of see that played out.
So overall, I think the note that I'd like to wrap up this topic on is that rape revenge films are morally murky by design. And it's so easy to misstep simply because there are no right or wrong ways to react to trauma. There is no true justice that can be had for a crime that is so deeply rooted in culture. Rape is a byproduct of patriarchy, and no one woman is going to fix that, no matter what she does specifically to her attacker. There's no real justice to be had there, and it's always going to feel a little bit unresolved. And I think if you look at other rape revenge films, both in the classic sense and the more modern ones, I took a cursory look back at Ms. 45, at The Brave One, at American Mary, at Teeth. These all have their own murky navigations of these ideas of sexuality and control and who has sexual control, because it's not always the rapist. Sometimes it's quite the opposite. Sometimes women get targeted because they have what is perceived to be too much sexual power.
I don't think these are easy films to watch, but I am glad they exist. These are not the films I like seek out on a quiet Saturday night. But I think they allow us some perverse feminist fantasy in a way. And what are films if not to allow us to dream? And sometimes in your dreams, it is about getting vengeance or overcoming some kind of misdeed which has befallen you. And these films, I think, act as kind of a strange feminist fantasy. And again, they operate on multiple different levels, not just between I Spit on Your Grave and Elle, but everything in between. And I'm sure there will be more films to come. But this is a problem that affects everyone. And if you have not been a victim or a survivor of rape or sexual assault, my money is on the fact that you probably know someone who has been, even if you don't know it. So that's why we tried to approach this episode with as much care and as much generosity as we could, understanding that we are talking about fictionalized representations of these things which are so relevant and heady within our culture.
Which is easier to talk about than the real thing. Perhaps you've had an experience that you're trying to sort through, and watching movies like this might actually help you. Who knows? We are going to leave resources in the course notes of this episode. We care about our listeners. We care about this subject. There are a lot of resources out there, so we hope that anyone who is struggling with this is taking care of themselves, and whether it means confronting it in horror movies the way Alex and I like to, or whatever way have you. Godspeed. I have to say that recording this episode was a lot less arduous than maybe I'd built it up to be. I mean, doing the research by myself alone at my computer, it's such a dark topic. It's such dark films. I got a little bit bummed out, but it wasn't so bad.
No, and it's weird because I think people out there might believe that like you and I live in a little clubhouse together, like children's show hosts or something. And we just kind of appear once a month and are like, blah, horror films. But we don't. We live separately from each other, which is sad for everyone. But it was. It was a very isolating thing to watch these films and think about them and think about myself and the women I know and process it in a way that would mean something to an audience out there all over the world.
Yeah.
And yeah, sitting and talking about this kind of stuff with someone who is receptive and will listen to you, and even if they don't agree on your subjective view of film, are still hearing you out and engaging with you is pretty powerful and one of the reasons why I love doing this so much.
All this to say that for our next episode, we are going to take a little bit of a departure into playtime. We've decided to go into video games and horror film. We talked a little bit about video games earlier in this episode. It's a very male-dominated industry. We are going to talk all about that stuff. But when it dabbles in the horror genre, the protagonists are often, and we have selected two movies that are based on horror video game franchise powerhouses. I know you've heard of these films, Resident Evil and Silent Hill.
Yeah, and we're doing like the first ones of both of them. I may talk about all the Resident Evil movies that I've seen in theaters, but for the purposes of this episode, please just watch the first two.
Video games and movies have a really interesting relationship because video games are their own form of interactive media. And having had my fingers in both worlds, sometimes I see video games that I feel like should be movies and sometimes vice versa. It's really interesting. I'm really excited to talk about it. So that is going to be our April episode. So make sure that you're subscribed to us and following us on social media so that you get a hold of that as soon as it's out.
And if you like what we do, and if you've got some extra time, please drop us a review on iTunes if you haven't already. Helps the show out a whole bunch, and only takes a little bit of your time.
That's it for us this month, guys. We'll see you next time. But until then,
office hours are closed.